Okay. Hey everyone, welcome to Faded Mates. This week we'll be talking about Regan the Radiant.
You're going rip.
Regan the Radiant. I'm so like, okay, fast. I'll slow down. I'm so excited. Ah!
Slow down. You guys were rolling.
Oh
excited.
My God. I didn't think I'd be excited about this one, but this week on Faded Mates, we're going to be discussing Dreams of a Dark Warrior. I remembered from memory.
I'm so impressed because I literally, every time I'm trying to reference it anywhere now, I'm just wrong.
Something interesting happens in my brain where I'm like, Regan, Declan, Dreams of a Dark Warrior. There's like a pause. So we are going to be talking about Regan and her 1,000-year-old reincarnated berserker.
Berserkers.
Torture Island. Lots and lots of Torture Island, and heavy on the torture this time.
Yeah, content warning, Torture Island.
Yeah, right,
it's funny because I think everybody's like, what is Torture Island? They keep saying Torture Island, and we saw it last book, but like, this book is the Torture Island book.
Yes, absolutely. It entirely takes place on Torture Island, right? There's not even really an escape from it
No. At the end, just to say, like, and they got off Torture Island.
Right, right. And I think also this is a book that, you know, we talked about the second movement and what it's doing, and this shows a lot of development of secondary subplots, some of which are going to be very important for movement 3, and some which are very important for the wrap-up of movement 2.
I was real impressed by the level of prep for movement 3 that is happening here. I highlighted as I was reading so many moments where I was like, this is Sweet Ruin. This is Wicked Abyss already established. I mean, this is bananas, Cressley. How are you holding 83 books in your head?
I'm back to wanting a picture of her murder wall.
Yes, same.
Because clearly it exists, well, or her brain is ready for science. Her brain will be taken to Torture Island and inspected by people there because it's got to be like the level of detail. And that's the thing. Last week we were talking, I think, or on Demon from the Dark, and you said, I think she's just sort of plodded through Lothair. And then you read this and you're like, oh, no.
No, now she's done. Like, I feel like she's plodded through Nyx at this point. And, I mean, we don't have any idea what that means, but...
she does.
Yeah. Interestingly, I think... I don't know. At this point, we've talked so much about these books that I never know what I've said and not said. But I know for a long time, or at some point during 2011, Cressley said publicly, or maybe it wasn't 2011, maybe it was earlier, but she said on some message board somewhere that Nyx and... that Fury and Kristoff were going to be connected.
Mm-hmm.
I think... anything that she said before Torture Island needs to be just, like, wiped clean off the slate. Because I feel like suddenly Torture Island expands the whole universe to such an immense degree that anything that she thought she might have prepared for earlier than that just can't possibly be valid in the scope of the world now.
Well, and one of the things that I was really struck by as a reader is, as a general, like, statement, I think it's very hard, and I don't mean this to sound as judgment. I don't mean it to sound judgmental. I mean to sound admiring. When authors make a bigger world, it can be very difficult to keep characters in check, to keep, like sort of keep all those balls juggling in the air, right? Like, it's really like watching a juggler at work, to use a Salman Rushdie analogy from a book called Haroon and the Stories, right? Storytelling is like juggling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what happens is in this book, there's so many like other things being woven in, but I never felt like it detracted from Regan and Declan. I felt like it helped build it up.
Yep.
And I think that is a tremendous accomplishment because I think it's really hard to then have like a chapter that's away from them or, you know, whatever, and still feel like the narrative thrust is moving forward, that you haven't just like put the car in neutral. And I think that's something really astounding about this book. There are entire subplots that are just so delicately woven through, mm-hmm. like little strands of gold, and it's just pretty, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So, okay, I want to just quickly, in a couple of sentences, talk about where we are. So, in Dreams of a Dark Warrior, no, false, that's what this is.
Yes.
Last book was Demon from the Dark. So in Demon from the Dark, we saw Malcolm and Caro on this other plane doing their own sort of essentially what was a snowed-in romance, but like over in an other world.
In hell.
Right, snowed-in in hell. But while that was all happening, concurrent to all of that, in IAD time, Torture Island is happening. So at the end of the Malcolm and Caro book, we see Torture Island like... Or not the end. It's sort of two-thirds of the way through, maybe, that book. Mm-hmm. We see Torture Island's demise. We see Caro and Malcolm escape. And then we see them have what I have referred to as a marriage and trouble book by the end, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
What we're seeing in this book, Dreams of a Dark Warrior, is what was happening while Caro and Malcolm were away. And we... really, in the last book, didn't get quite so much of what really, the sort of horrors of Torture Island. What is really, right. really happening to these characters. This book feels, there were a couple of really moments that made me flinch hard in this. Because they felt, it felt gruesome. In a way that we've never seen, we've seen other heroes and heroines tortured over the course of the series. We've never seen anything like this. Okay, so where do we want to start? What do we want to talk about? Because I have a lot to say. I also want to say, and this, I have never reread this book. It's one of the ones I skip. I skip it because Declan Chase, in my mind, is not the Declan Chase who I read again on this reread.
I completely agree. I mean, in my mind, I was kind of like, that just happened, but I skip over it. And one of the things we should also say is at the end of this podcast, we have a special guest with us, Sarah Hawley, one of the Wicked Wallflowers, because this is one of her, this is her favorite IAD book. And that's just not a real common thing.
No, poor Sarah, and, though. She's now she's sort of pointed to on the internet as like, well, she's the one who likes Declan Chase.
You know
Chase.
What? I will now join her in that,
I'm
right?
Sort of like team Declan after this reread.
I think.
It's troublesome.
Sure.
There's but you a know whole what? Lot I happening.
I think for me, at its core, it's really about how radical it is truly to promise to love someone for better or worse. What? How or worse do we really mean? And I think that once I kind of turned that like lens on, it just made like my reading of it, like I felt it was a really powerful story. And I think there's a lot of really interesting things to talk about. So we're obviously going to talk about Declan, but I think we're going to focus on Declan more when we have Sarah on with us.
Yeah.
And so I think we have tons of other things that we're going to talk about, but I think it might be interesting to maybe start with Regan.
So I think there's something really interesting happening in this book, which is Cressley is, this is a really different book structurally than any yes. of the other books that she's written. And it's structurally yes. different for a lot of reasons. One, there are a ton more characters than usual. Mm-hmm. And a ton more characters who, I mean, all, obviously, every time one of these books happens, we see characters from all over the lore kind of pop in and out. But usually there's like, the heroine and like one close friend and then a bunch of sort of secondary or tertiary characters. Or there's a hero and his brother, or a hero and his cousin, right? In this particular case, what you have is all these people on an island together, and each one of them, what Cressley's done is she's figured out a way to move, it's chess. It's setting us up for Lothair. This whole book is setting us up for Lothair. And it is, I think, a game of chess that's happening here where there are so many different characters who are all essential to the story, even in their minor roles, right?
Absolutely.
And then there comes this point where it's really like a team movie. I say all the time that I really love in movies and TV shows when a large group of people working together, all wearing sunglasses, do a slow walk out of a building, like a heist.
Right. Oh, yeah, for sure.
And this really does feel a little heisty with, like, at the end, this kind of collection of a motley crew of characters working
together. It's like Reservoir Dogs to me, right? Like, they all walk out and there's this, like, soundtrack playing. But I want you to talk about the fact that last week we were like, there's never an epilogue. The whole, like, fairy tale structure setup I thought was really interesting, too.
Yeah.
The fact, and it's, you know, the fact that it's sort of told like a tale, right? And that there's then this, like, epilogue, like a fairy tale, I just thought was really interesting.
Well, these fairy tales, then we move, when we move forward, we start to see Nyx is telling these stories. And you start to kind of wonder, like, has Nyx been telling, is Nyx our narrator through all of this?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Which is really a mind fuck when you think about, like, suddenly you're like, oh, wait, there's a whole new structure at play here. And then on top of it, I mean, there are lots of craft things that I'm sure we'll get into, but on top of all this, this is the first of the books where it's really not the heroine's story at all.
And I think it also is in a way that's really unexpected, which is so I guess what I mean by that is there's this really fascinating thing about, like, Aiden, like, who is Aiden, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is Aiden Declan or is Declan Aiden, right? This sort of push-pull. And she kind of blows into that thinking, I'm just me. Mm-hmm. And her experience on Torture Island makes her question that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not just Declan sort of being stronger than Aiden. I think it's that Regan changes too, that allows them to, like, beat this.
Sure.
And I think that's a really interesting part. Like, right, we talk about, like, dynamic characters changing. And she does change, but it's like him through something terrible happening to her.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think also there's this piece, right, where Declan is, so he's a reincarnate. He's the first we've seen of this world. And he's come back, I think this is the fifth time, maybe the sixth time.
The fifth time.
And Regan has every time, you get this sort of very real sense that every time he's come back, he's returned, she's stagnant, right? She hasn't, she's definitely older and more powerful, and she's, you know, the Valkyries have, all the Valkyrie stuff has happened, and she's certainly nothing to sneeze at. But every time they return to this push-pull of fated mates, that's, or this curse, whatever it is that's happened to them. And it's never 100% clear what has happened to them. I think this is just one of those really interesting moments where, like, we talk as romance readers about how certain things, like, don't get wrapped up in the world building because nobody really cares. And this is a good example of, like, Cressley didn't get wrapped up in the world building of what actually happened to Declan and Regan.
Yeah, and the characters even address it. She, like, Regan says something like, we can't even fully understand the lore ourselves.
And there it
like
is. Done.
Right?
I mean, it's fine.
Right?
So that's sort of a nice writerly lesson. Like, don't worry so much about it. Like, as long as the readers are in the story, it doesn't 100% matter all the time. But what I wanted to say about that is that for the last four incarnations of Aiden, I think Regan has been the kind of young girl in love that she was,
right?
A young girl kind of playing at love even in those earlier things, right? It's been a game.
Well, and this time, refusing to let herself really love, right? Like, it's also willful.
Sure. Like, she doesn't, I think she has been sort of toying with herself and him in all these other incarnations. Like, she tells the story about how when they met in medieval France, you know, she was on a rampart and he was, you know, attacking the castle that she was defending. And, like, they had this great banter and then they just tumbled into bed together. Right?
Right.
And in this particular case, it's not easy, right? Declan's not easy. So, of course, this love is going to evolve for her in a very different way. And at some point late in the book, she says, like, I didn't love him.
Yeah.
And she, what's interesting is she tells him that before she's come to a place where she has forgiven Chase and loves him. But she's realizing that, like, that sort of childhood infatuation is not the same as earned love.
Right. Well, and I think a really heartbreaking moment in this book for me is the first time Aiden dies. And she's so, he's like, I still don't have your heart. Like, he knows it. And it's the power of that unrequited love, I think, that really powers kind of whatever happens next.
Yeah, like, it's this, what brings him back.
Yeah, like, their story is never going to be finished until that gets fixed, right? Like, that pattern is doomed on repeat, not because they're cursed, but because they don't commit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or she doesn't, maybe.
Well, maybe both of them, right? Because there's, I don't know, because I think that Declan also realized there's revelation for him. This really, for me, was a book, and I mean, this is not, I mean, congratulations, Sarah, you read a book and saw the plot, but I mean, this is Declan's revelation, the whole book. It's so medieval, this kind of sense of he's learning all the love languages, like, he has to learn how to love Regan, he has to learn how to love Brander, his second in command, who is so deeply loyal to him and remarkable. What a great character.
Yeah, I know. I want him back, right? Ugh. Well, he has to learn to love himself.
Yeah. I mean, of course, right? But he also, like, has to learn how to trust people in general. Like, the fact that he has to learn to trust Lothair. I mean, the idea that in any one of these books that you have to rely on trusting Lothair is really pretty great.
It's quite a thing.
Right.
Yeah,
forcing. Right? And what I think Cressley's doing, look, the hardest thing in the world is writing a villain as a hero. I know this because I've done it. I'm currently doing it. The last book in the Bare Knuckle Bastards series is villain as hero. The last book, or the second to last book in the Wallflower series, the Devil in Winter, is villain as hero. Villain as hero is certainly, it is its own romance trope, but it is really difficult to do because you can't pull your punches when you're writing a villain in order to set him up to be a hero. But ultimately, he's going to have to atone for every one of his sins. And in this particular case, the challenge for Cressley and for Declan is atonement is enough atonement. And in order for him to do that, you have to push him against, to atone, you have to give up your blood to Lothair. To atone, you have to, like, be loyal to this band of Detris, right?
Right.
To atone, you have to suffer watching you have to relinquish you have to suffocate your fated mate, right? For her own, for her own benefit. I mean, there are so many moments where he's so punished.
Yeah. And I will tell you, I could have used a little more.
I know. It's always a thing.
Here's where I struggled. I actually didn't struggle with the acts of atonement part because I did really see that he did suffer through that. I think a part that I really personally struggled with, and I guess we can talk about this, Sarah, too, is that, like, the whole vivisection thing, he doesn't really realize how terrible it is until it happens to Regan. And I felt a little like, it's like a man who understands women's rights are important once they have a daughter. Like, that's what it took.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the, I also needed to see a fuller picture of like past regret, maybe.
Yeah, what's the name of that church that protests funerals? That terrible.
Oh, God, those terrible people.
Those terrible, horrible people. Yeah, but there was a woman who was raised in that church, and then she escaped. And then I saw her, I saw an interview with her on that Sarah Silverman show, I Love You, America. And she was fascinating because she was like, it never occurred to me that I was being told the wrong thing.
That I was brainwashed.
Exactly. And her interview, we'll link it in show notes. We'll also remember the name. I'm doing very well with memory of things.
That's
today,
okay. But I'm like, I know what it is, but I can't come up with the name. It's fine.
We'll point it out in show notes. But but we'll post this interview too, because I think that's where we are with Declan. Like, I think he was so destroyed as a teen. He was 17 when his parents were killed by the Provis creatures.
Yeah.
They attacked him and tortured him. He was saved by Webb, who is basically a genocidal maniac.
Right.
And Webb told him, you are one of many. They are legion. All immortals are the same. Come and fight them with me. And so you can sort of see how a 17-year-old would say, like, okay, that seems right. Right? This is why I say all the time when I teach, like, writing, that revenge works as a conflict, because it's never a good, it never resolves itself well, right? Like,
yeah, right.
I do think, here's the thing, for the lion's share of this book, I was like, has Cressley given us enough of the of Declan's torture at the beginning? And then Lothair drinks him and dreams his torture. And you see Lothair, the enemy of old, who ultimately we will know. I mean, maybe the reread of this book is better than the first read of this book, because we come into it eyes wide open. We're going to see what kind of torture Lothair has suffered as in his own existence, and hit the idea that he might dream torture that
scares him,
terrifies him, is pretty magnificent, right?
Well, I also think it's a really, like, radical question about, like, where we place ourselves as a reader versus the characters, right? Like, it doesn't really matter if I don't forgive Declan if Regan does.
I don't know. Is that true?
I don't know either. I'm asking that as a question, right? Like, I don't think it's entirely true, because if we didn't trust the characters or the authors, we wouldn't keep reading.
Well, I think we'd never say, like, oh, what an unlikable heroine, if we trusted the characters.
Yeah, it's like a really interesting question, right? Like, what does it mean to have Regan forgive him, even if we're not quite sure? And I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if there is an answer.
All right.
I'm sure you faced that with Malcolm in Day of the Duchess.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you did,
and
right?
I'm doing it now with Ewan in the next book. But I think, I mean, yeah, you spend all your time worrying, like, are they atoning enough? Are they groveling enough? Is there enough here? Well, let's talk about how I think the biggest way that she gets around sort of this measure of atonement is by using all these extra characters. So let's talk about some of these extra characters and what's happening. Because I think there's Lothair, and obviously we need to do Lothair watch. It feels like we're just moving to a place where we're going to have to talk about Lothair more and more and more until we get to Lothair.
Right.
And then there's Thad, who we are introduced to long before Thad becomes important to the arc of the story. Because Thad is really the driving force of the third movement of IAD.
Yeah. Well, I think one way we can, and I think we need to talk about Brander and Natalia. Right?
And so McGreeve. I think we have McGreeve coming in.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's a really interesting thing at the end, though, too, which is we were talking about, like, Caro and Malcolm's book and, like, the timeline. It's implied at the end of Demon from the Dark that they intend to go back. And they do show up then at the end of this book, right? So then we can sort of place things in order.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this pretty amazing scene where, like, Malcolm basically stabs Declan, right? And Regan's like, God damn it. And Carol's like, ooh, I didn't know you were in love with him. And I think, and I found it it, like, this, one of the things I thought was really remarkable about that scene is Carol being able to quickly forgive him, and even a Malcolm to some extent, I think is because they themselves are so, like, looked down upon, right? So like, Carol knew all along, people are not going to understand me with this Veman. And so I think she being the one to show up and, like, sort of be like, "Ooh, sorry," showed Regan that, like, acceptance is going to, like, actually crawl out of somewhere, because there are lots of people now. The accession is bringing people together that have never been together. And that's going to open up, like, not just new romances between individuals, but, like, new romances between alliances and groups of people. And sometimes that works out and sometimes it doesn't. Like, the Natalia Brander, like, we both zigged when we meant to zag or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there's a lot of really interesting things happening here that are...
It's such a different book. It's... Yes. And I kept thinking to myself, it is where Untouchable was... When we talked about Untouchable during the novella episode, I talked a lot about how I thought, like, craft-wise, what Cressley was doing with Untouchable was really exploring the scope of the world she was writing.
Yeah.
In this book, I think Cressley is exploring the scope of the character arcs that she can write, right? She's laying so much thread for the future.
It's amazing.
Let's talk about Regan at the very beginning and then Thad. Because, so, two things. One, Talia Hibbert stopped reading this, has never read this book, and she, on Twitter a few weeks ago, tweeted that she stopped reading this book because Regan is 12 during the prologue of this book.
Every friend of mine who's read it has texted me and was like, she's 12.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, so let's just talk this through, because she is 12. She has just escaped. So the Valkyrie mythology says that Valkyries are born of three parents, a dying warrior, a female warrior,
yeah,
who is dying in battle, who cries out to Freya and Woden and is immediately brought up to Valhalla pregnant with a Valkyrie. Also, somebody tweeted at us or text or put it in Instagram. Well, I'll find the person and asked us a very specific question about this, like, about consent and this, like, Valkyries being, like, lifted up from battle, but then turned into vessels for Valkyries, which is interesting. I mean, it's an interesting question. Like,
it is.
And I just want to say it out loud, because when I read it, I texted it to Jen and I was like, oh, this is really an interesting, like, question of, like, what is happening here? Because they are becoming sort of vessels of the gods, but they are also birthing warriors. So it's an interesting push-pull. Anyway. And then they get to grow up in Valhalla, which is, seems like a pretty great place to grow up. But yeah. Lucia, as we know from two books ago, from whatever the hell that book was called.
Pleasure of a Dark Prince.
Thank you very much. Oh, Jen's so good at this. Lucia escaped Valhalla to marry Kruach and head out to her, you know, life trauma. And Regan loves her sister. These two are sisters of blood and also of heart, right?
Yeah.
So Regan leaves to find Lucia and help her, but she's 12 and she lands in war. And she turns up in the, like, longhouse of Aiden the Fierce, and when she meets him, she's 12. But kind of a badass Valkyrie already. Like, ballsy. She's very Regan.
He's 30.
And
he recognizes, essentially, that, yeah.
He basically says, like, we're going to be mated eventually.
Yeah.
You're going to be my wife. Because I'm going to become a berserker. Woden's going to give me immortality. And when I am immortal, you and I are going to be married. But it's not gross. At least it wasn't.
It's a little gross.
Okay. It was not gross for me. It was not gross for me because, and we talked about this on the Scottish episode, but it really echoed that Julie Garwood book, The Gift, for me, where there's like sort of an arranged marriage and the hero is much older than the heroine, who is like a child in that book, 4 or 5 years old. And like, he's just holding, like, he's literally like holding her like a toddler on his hip. And he's like, this is for the future. And then it ends, and then they come back when they're older. And it does. In this case, the 12-year-old, you know, it ends, and then he comes back, or she comes back when she's 20, and then they marry.
It wasn't gross. That's too strong. There was one part I was like, which was like a buxom serving maid comes in to bring her a glass of milk, which is pretty funny. And Regan essentially wishes her boobs were bigger.
Yeah.
Like, she's 12, and she's kind of like, eh. Well, what I really want to do is I want to talk about Thad, who's 16, just turned 17, like very Sound of Music. And then I want to talk about Regan at the end regretting that she never went back to find Declan as a young man.
To protect
like younger,
him.
To right?
protect him.
To protect him. And I think that's when it closed the loop.
The moment where she was looking at the serving girl and she was thinking, like, that felt it, it. I mean, like, look, we all come to our, you know, sexual identity, or like we are awakened sexually at different ages, right? And I think in that particular, it really rang true to me that, like, as a prepubescent girl, like as a middle schooler, yeah. right? You teach sure. middle school, like, you're sort of exploring this idea of, like, well, what is sexuality? Like, how do I, like, what is it to be attractive? Like, how is that? And none of this is in the text, really, but it is just sort of a fleeting moment of, like, what if I were beautiful like that?
Well, and one of the things I actually have always really respected about this series is that Cressley has never flinched from the idea that teenagers are sexual beings. Is it Mariquetta that had the boyfriend when she was 16 and they just had great sex for a couple of years? And, you know, and
sure, sure. He was a werewolf or something.
Right. I mean, and so part of me is like, it's, you know,
and Thad too. Thad thinks he's going to die and fills his backpack with condoms and beer.
Condoms. I know. But I think actually that's, and I'd said this to you in a text this morning, like, I feel like if you read this book and you're really upset about her being 12, and I understand that, and then you make it through the whole book, but you're not just as interested in the idea that Thad is 17. He just turned 17, and these immortal women,
like,
are kind of macking on him.
Thousands of years old. Okay, so
yes.
let's jump forward to that, because Thad is put in the cell, a catatonic Thad.
Oh, God, yes.
Put in a cell with Natalia, who is a dark fae, which will become very important again in Act 3 of this series. So Natalia is a dark fae. Dark fae are poisonous. In this book, they are poisonous only to vampires, by the way, it looks like.
Well, she has her torque on.
Oh,
and so it's kind of waved away a little bit.
But Lothair says you couldn't have been with her because she's poisonous to our kind. But what's interesting, so again, that's going to alter over time, and ultimately she will be poisonous to everyone. But right now she is poisonous. And then there is Regan in there. And Regan is, Regan. So, and they sort of see it. So he's catatonic, and then he wakes up and he's basically like, I was going on a date with presumably Chloe, right?
No, there are other magisters.
Okay, it's not Webb's daughter.
And it was another magister. It's not Webb's daughter. It's one of the other magisters.
Okay, so he was basically like going to go on a date with one of the other magister's daughters, and then he got stuck there, and you as the reader are like, what is happening? And then one of the girls in the, one of the, you know, whatever, either Regan or Natalia say, well, it's been more than a week and you haven't eaten. So
yeah,
you're definitely not human.
Right.
And this is when Thad discovers, like, oh, I'm a baby something.
Yeah.
So what I really love about that is that the moment they sort of discover that he doesn't know what he is, he becomes like the Ruby of this book. Like, the sort of, they're protecting him, but I mean, yeah, he has a lot of wet dreams.
it was more uncomfortable for me to at some scenes to see how they like sexualized him than it was for me to see how Aiden treated her when she was 12.
Well, because he like, doesn't sexualize her when she's 12.
Right, at all. But and but they do.
No, he's basically like, can we get her a glass of milk?
Yes. And and it's really interesting to me that, I mean, they name him Tiger because his penis essentially is so big and he's getting hard-ons all the time.
Yeah. Now, they do think that he's over 18.
And then they do.
The moment he says, I'm 17, there's, like, a record scratch.
Like, actually in the text. Yeah, totally. Right. And so I think that, but I think what's really interesting about it, too, is Declan is also 17. And I think what I ended up thinking about, like, them in totality is how kids, whether we like it or not, are sometimes faced with adult horrors.
Yeah.
And forced to deal with them.
Yep.
And that could happen at 12, and it could happen at 15, yep, or 16, or 17. And that's just the way of the fuck, or 7.
Yes.
Right? For, like, Ruby. And I found myself feeling kind of at peace with that, as, like, yeah, that's true.
I also think Thad then becomes this sort of talisman. It's really interesting, because then suddenly all the characters in the lore, once... It's like Cressley establishes him as being only 17, and suddenly everyone is like, oh God, we have to protect him. And when I say everyone, I mean literally everyone. I mean Lothair.
Even
and I
Lothair.
Want to talk about Lothair Watch now, because Thad and Lothair are like the buddy cop movie.
I didn't know I wanted, but and yet I want it all the time.
All I want is like the Thad and Lothair show forever. Because...
Yes.
Thad is pure, wonderful Texas gentleman. And Lothair.
It's the cutest thing.
And Lothair is a fucking monster. And they together are like the most darling couple ever.
Yes, it's true. It's so cute.
Because Thad's always like, Mr. Lothair, can I help you get out of this? You know, I'll help you, like, up off this cliff where you've just kicked a one-eyed goddess into oblivion.
Can I just, like, everybody right now, I think Lothair is Odysseus. I will talk more about that next week or 2 weeks from now. Just be ready. Because I was driving home and was like, oh, shit. That's so real.
And then Jen was like, if Lothair ever touches a one-eyed creature, I know I have a theory.
Like,
I was like, he just kicked a one-eyed Dorada into a hole. So it's probably
so
real.
Much.
Anyway, we'll get to Lothair. We'll put a pin in Lothair as Odysseus. But the point is that that is so helpful. And then when they get to the point when they're on the tarmac and the Wendigos are coming, and he's like, I'm going to fight with you, Mr. Lothair. And Lothair is like, get the fuck away from me.
I know.
And then we start to see, and then Lothair decks him, and he, like, mm-hmm. takes off. And then we start to see Lothair using Lothair speak for the first time with Thad. Because Thad's like, are we buddies now? And Lothair's like, why would you ask me that question?
Right? Yes, of course. Of course.
He's delightful.
Oh, God. He's such a great character. And you know what I would say about Thad, though, too? There's this amazing moment, like probably my favorite moment in any of these books. Although I have also said that I would read fanfic about like all the Immortals After Dark men in group therapy together. The close
that's a Kate Claiborne.
I know.
Shout out.
I was like,
none of these, all these guys need to fuck it out. But none of them go to therapy.
And I was like, group therapy?
Can you imagine, though,
the closest we get is in this book where these motherfuckers bond over the warm beer out of Thad's backpack.
Oh, no, it's so funny.
It so is
Thad
the best.
Has been carrying his backpack for like a week, and it's filled with like, and so everybody just, Declan thinks he's got food in there. He's like, oh, smart kid, he's got food in there. And then it turns out he's got warm Budweiser, condoms, toothpaste.
And there's something else.
One other thing.
What else was there?
I can't remember.
Hold on, I'm going to look.
But it's perfection. And then they're like, well, I guess we're all just going to drink this beer with this kid.
Yeah, but you know what's the most amazing part about that scene, though? condoms, cologne.
Cologne.
Condoms. I've got condoms, cologne, toothpaste, essentials, he says. You know what's amazing, though, about this scene is they're all strategizing how they can help Declan win Regan back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all these crazy-ass machinations. And Sad's like, well, my gran always says that sometimes men just forget to say, I'm sorry. And
accurate, then.
That baby has the best advice. Just but listen also, to him.
Can we talk about how Lothair is fucking right? That whole scene where Lothair is like, no, you don't go grovel. Yeah. You go into her and you fight. What does he say? Live by the sword, love by the sword. My God, I want it's that amazing. As a tattoo. Like, that's it. I was like, well, I don't have a tattoo because I never know what it should be. It's that. It's live by the sword, love by the sword.
And so all the Odysseus tattoos, all the Ulysses tattoos.
That violent scene between them. Yeah. Where he goes for her and he just lets her wail on him by the water is really a wonderful scene. And it's so I know this is a controversial film for a lot of people, but I love the movie Mr. and Mrs. Smith with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. Because I love it when two incredibly strong characters
beat the shit out of each other.
And I also, and I don't know. I mean, there's no kink shaming here. Sometimes I think that's super hot. Like, I want it.
It was super hot.
Right? Only if they're even, right? Like,
right.
And in this case, he's not. He's just everything he does to her is about giving her pleasure and taking her pain from her.
And it has to be that way because he caused her so much pain.
Of course.
And the big thing about her, like, I mean, she actually says something like, now she was defeated and at the hands of a man who should have defended her.
Mm-hmm.
She literally must beat him up in order to, like, gain that feeling of power back. Mm-hmm. A physical defeat at the hands of Declan Chase, like, must mean that she at some point is going to, like, turn that back on him as physical rage.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it has to be that way.
And he deserves every blow she delivers him.
And he knows that. Yeah. And he takes it. And honestly, that's one of the scenes that I was like, yes, this is what you need to do right now. You need to literally let her beat the crap out of you.
And Lothair knows it.
Absolutely.
What's amazing is that Lothair, so through this whole, the lead up, and I had forgotten the end of this book.
Oh, interesting.
I had forgotten how it all comes to pass that Declan becomes immortal. And what's interesting is that basically Lothair behaves as a parent from the start here, right? Like he makes the deal with Declan and for, you know, endless blood so that he can dream the last known location of his ring, right?
Yes.
And find out who has the ring. But also, he then gives him this, like, really paternal advice. Like, it's perverted, but it's, like, very paternal, the advice that he gives about how to win Regan back. And then he has this experience with Thad where he, like, protects Thad and, like, keeps Thad safe. And then, ultimately, he literally sires or, I mean, essentially, he is willing to give his blood for to sire Chase as a vampire, to keep him alive.
Yeah.
And that's
right.
That isn't ultimately how Chase is kept alive. But his willingness to play essentially dad to this character is really interesting. I think it's really interesting that the only time we ever see vampires sired, I mean, obviously we see all the Roth brothers sired, but it's a different thing because they've been sired in the past. But the only time we see people sired in the series are Lothair sires two people.
Oh, interesting.
One is Chase and the other we'll get to.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think, like, one of the things we see in this particular book is all these, like, opposites, right? So Webb, he thought was his father-like figure, and he turns out to be a betrayer. And Lothair then sort of, like, steps in and takes that place, and he's also a betrayer, but it's somehow different, right? Like, because ultimately Lothair's parenting, quote-unquote, quote is more,
big air quotes.
I know, I'm like, whatever we're going to call that, is more honest.
It's lore parenting. Oh my God, it's episode 2.
Lore parenting trips. Oh my God, it's more.
If you want to win the girl, just let her beat you up.
Yeah. Love there. So, I mean, I think that's like really interesting. The way, like, that idea of, like, a father, it's like a father figure that steered him wrong by lying to him mm-hmm. versus this father figure who it's, like, all tough love, right?
Yeah. And, like, really deeply honest. Like,
yeah,
the one thing Lothair is honest. He literally cannot lie. So there are two other things that I think are really interesting here. One is that in the text here, Lothair seems to be able to, if you drain a body completely, which is how Lothair gets his red eyes, you assume their power as well as their memories. That goes away. That no longer, like, that's a sort of throwaway line here that we never see again. And then I want to talk about Vows to the Lore. Can we talk about Vows to the Lore?
Can you believe it was this book?
Yep. So the Vow to the Lore exists now. It is, and it is canon as of now that if you vow something to the lore, you cannot ever take it back. And that will be a huge piece of at least Lothair and all books following, but I assume next book too. I haven't reread.
Lothair is next.
Oh shit, Lothair is next.
Girl.
Oh my God, it's happening.
I know.
You guys, I can't believe we're so far in.
I know.
I mean, we were just little babies a few months ago.
I know.
Here we are. You guys, Lothair's almost here. It's almost over. It's like Lothair and then just goes. But Monroe is coming.
I know.
Someday.
Well, season 2.
Yeah.
I think the Vows to the Lore thing's really interesting because Declan Chase, we know, has lied to Caro explicitly, right? I'm going to let you go, and then doesn't. And then in this book, his vows take on new meaning, both because he knows that he's part of the lore, but because we see that he now takes making promises seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one of those subtle signals that he has really changed.
Yeah. Yes. So Dorada is here. Dorada has come. We see Dorada arrive. We see Lothair really pissed off. Like, I think he's just ready. Like, he's ready to take her on because he's just like, where's my ring? This place is terrible. Bring her. And she comes.
It's like a wedding ring. This is the other thing that made me think of Odysseus, right? It's just a plain gold band.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't have, like, it's not like the Lord of the Rings ring where it has something engraved on it or whatever.
No, it's just a ring. It's just it's a MacGuffin.
Which is why I think it's fascinating they, like, can't figure out what it is. They only know it's important because it's important to him.
Mm-hmm.
Not because it itself gives off any sort of, or seeming to, right?
We don't know what it is yet, do we? It's really interesting because I have, you know, I say a lot. I say, well, that's a problem for future Sarah. And I have a feeling that Dorada's ring is a problem for future Cressley. Like, she knows it's important. And when she gets to Lothair's book, it'll become very clear what it does. But right now,
absolutely,
it doesn't matter. It's just moving us through a couple of
places. It's also really interesting to me, like, if we're talking about things that are kind of left on the table, that there are other torture islands, that there are other magisters, that just the destruction of this one island doesn't actually mean that the order is gone, although they kind of disappear after this book.
Well, no, they come back in McGreeve.
Oh.
Because Webb.
Yeah, I guess I still associate all those books still with, like, this timeline.
Yeah.
I'm just saying for future, right? Way future.
Yeah. So we're seeing a couple things. Let's talk about, we need to have Sarah on. So let's talk about, we are seeing the groundwork laid. So like we've said, we are seeing the groundwork laid for the entire third movement in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this book is basically just like a giant prologue for Lothair. And then we are seeing the groundwork for McGreeve. here.
Yep.
Because by the end of this book, Cressley's canonized the idea that many of the lore kind have accepted a kind of deal with Chase and the Order. But is it with the Order at the end? But McCreeve has not accepted this deal. Like, he
right,
is not
right.
interested in this. We also, McCreeve is the first character who we actually see vivisected. He comes out of the vivisection
yes.
and he's been... And we see McCreeve attacked by succubi here, which is going to be important when we get to him.
Yeah. We also see Vicente and his succubi girlfriend, though. And it's like one of my favorite moments is like that Declan's like, he doesn't have his shirt on and she looks real healthy. And I was all,
they just did
I know
it.
What they were doing. Oh, I will say like one thing that really strikes me going back to the whole like kids see things is it's really explicit in the text that, like, once all these creatures get free, there's both killing and raping. And it's pretty all over the place, right? Like, it's just happening. It's just this crazy, like literally anything goes. I'm glad there's not a lot of detail because my brain is really upset by it.
It's interesting because incubi and succubi have to, the way that they feed is through sex. And we start to learn a lot about the world building of succubi and incubi when we get to McCreeve, but we don't know any of that stuff. I mean, I really do think it's interesting because I said this once before and now I'm just saying it again because I'm reminded of it. And I just had this thought within the last hour, but on the reread, this book becomes more tolerable.
Yes.
Because of things like how Cressley codes the rules of succubuses or succubi. And, or like how Cressley codes what Thad is.
Yep.
Suddenly things start to feel different. And that's.
Right. Because we know more, right?
I know more than new readers do here. So what I guess I will say is this is probably the most, for me so far at least, and I think I've reread all the other ones in the series except for Dark Sky. But right now, I would say this is the most, this is the darkest of the books, and it is the most uncomfortable of the books for me.
Yeah, and I think even though I liked it better, that will remain true.
Yeah. Let's talk about vivisection. You want to do Lost Limbs?
How even?
I know. So I do think vivisection counts, because they like take everything yeah. out and then put it back in.
Yeah.
There's a graphic description of the vivisection in this book that's not
great.
I'll
tell you what was even harder for me was her like them. Yeah. I like can't even say it, right? Like
it's when
Brander
she's
basically
explaining
is like
what they did
yes.
to her.
But like there's a moment where like they wire your rib cage back together and staple you, and Brander's like those aren't going to come out by themselves. We need to take them out. And that scene of the lore kind undoing what humans have done.
Yeah, it's brutal. It's brutal to watch.
Yes.
And it's there. And I'm kind of, but I get it. I get why we have to see it. We have to see it because we have to believe that Declan has been punished by viewing it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think it's really important. The scene I thought you were going to say the moment where Regan explains to Declan
oh, God.
What happened and the experience and then says and all I begged for you. I begged for you to stop it. And he was high in his room. He wasn't there. So there are really like there is it is the I usually like don't flinch at.
Right.
At physical torture, but it is grim. And what I would say is that from this moment on, I don't think we see it on the page quite like this ever again.
I agree. I think that's probably true.
Okay, but I do want to say two things. One, so yes, I think vivisection is real. I think we have to count Regan's.
Sure.
I think we have to count McReeve's vivisection as well, because it's an important...
And Brander, even though he doesn't appear again, right?
Right, but I think McReeve's vivisection is essential to what is to come in his book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also think to add to the I will bring you the heads of your enemies.
Declan does behead lots and lots of creatures
Declan
for her.
Well, yes, that. But also there's a moment where he takes somebody by the neck and he squeezes until their eyes pop right out of their head and then their head just falls right off.
Yes. Like, he literally, I mean, it's like a whole nother level of beheading as gesture. Yeah, yeah, for sure. I was like, oh, there it is. And there it is again. Yep. Nope, another one.
And then I think we have to count the skin flaying of the how do you pronounce it? How does Robert pronounce it? The Neptera.
I don't know if I listen.
Yeah. They call them Neos for short, but his skin is flayed by the Neos. And then there's the plane crash. But I don't think anybody loses anything in the plane crash.
No. I mean, if we counted Lothair cutting off La Dorada's finger, I think we should also, because she has one eye, and then he pokes out the other and throws her over.
He kicks the other eye out, right?
Because it's the Cyclops. Spoiler alert. I think.
Yeah, La Dorada's eye has to count. Sure.
Yeah.
And there it is.
You'll disconnect him.
I'll vivisect him.
You'll open wide him.
I'll subdivide him.
Oh, dear, 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 dear.
Also, I want to shout out Mike Rowe. I meant to shout this out earlier in the podcast, but Nyx has an obsession with Mike Rowe, the Dirty Jobs guy.
Yes.
What's actually very funny is my mom is almost 80 years old, and she too has an obsession with Mike Rowe, the Dirty Jobs guy. So maybe this is just a thing that older women have.
Who knew?
I didn't know. Cool. And what I love is in one of the books, not this one, but in one of them, he has a restraining order out against her.
It's so amazing,
which
honestly
is lovely. And that is my whole list. Oh, and medieval French. Oh, so okay. I want to talk just for 2 seconds about medieval French because as I said to Jen, like, I love having a podcast so much because if we had like an actual radio show or anything that had, you know, professionalism related to it, they would say, no, you may not send, you may not spend 5 minutes talking about medieval French, but we're going to. So as part of the story, during one of his reincarnations, Regan and Chase find each other, and he is a French knight, and she is defending a castle, and he comes to her and he says, surrender your castle or I'll raise it to the ground. And Regan says, that didn't sit well with me, so I voiced my opinion, which was that you should go copulate with a pig, and it sounded way cooler in medieval French. And then she says, later he said, you defend that rampart, female, and I answered, to the death, prick, again. One way cooler in medieval French. And because we live in remarkable times, you guys.
Remarkable times.
I went to Twitter and I said, is anyone an expert in medieval French and could do some translation for us, which we will pay you in podcast accolades. Here they are. and Heather Pagan, I don't know if this is her actual name, but she's Heather_Pagan on Twitter. And she is the editor of the Anglo-Norman Dictionary of Medieval French.
I just want you to know my whole heart, everybody.
I mean, this is magnificent. And she lives in Wales, and she's amazing. And she instantly offered to translate this information. She also gave us a ton of information on Regency swearing and some links that we will put in show notes.
Yeah,
she was remarkable. We also are going to link to the dictionary that she edits in case any of you, you know, would like to have an Anglo-Norman dictionary. And she has recorded the the language for us, and we'll make sure that we put it in so you guys can hear this.
Va foutre un porcel. Dame, défendis-tu le terrain? À la mort, Ripo.
Thank you so much, Heather. This is awesome.
But keep in mind, Regan's ability to insult people in modern English is also pretty great, because one of my favorite moments in this book is when she tells Chase, if he takes her swords, that she'll use them to slice off his nutsack. And then it's a pause for a coin purse.
Oh my God. Yes. And also, we haven't talked about this, but like, she, Regan fights with two swords that are attached to her back at all time.
Mm-hmm.
And they were gifts from Aiden. He taught her that because she was so little, she shouldn't use a broadsword. She should be using two blades instead of one. And it's really amazing. And at some point, Declan touches them and he can like feel that they're
like this jolt of energy.
There's something
in
them.
But you know what? You know what's amazing though about Declan is he will actually let her fight. And Aiden never wanted to. And it's just another, like, hint that he's, like, a better match for her. Which is the perfect lead-in to us talking to our special guest, Sarah Hawley, from The Wicked Wallflowers. Sarah Hawley is, like, a unicorn, but in the most amazing way.
As though most unicorns are very ordinary.
Obviously. And here's why. Not because of her amazing, awesome Wicked Wallflowers podcast, not because she's a friend of ours, not because of her just like utter gorgeousness and super smarts, but also because if you look at the IADA spreadsheet of wonder, she's like the only person who has Declan Chase as her number one top superhero.
Yeah.
And he's so my fave. We wanted you here, Sarah, to talk about yourself, maybe introduce yourself, but also we're talking about Declan and about sex. So hello. Great.
Yeah. Great. Well, I'm Sarah. I'm a magical unicorn because I love Declan Chase. So Jenny and I have been doing the Wicked Wallflowers podcast for like a year and a half now. And that's obviously how I met you guys. And that's been fantastic. And then Immortals After Dark, I got into in college. I found Dark Needs at Night's Edge at the public library. And I was like, yeah, sexy ghosts. I'm
our
into it.
Our favorite.
It's so good. And so I just read it and I was obsessed and immediately read all of them and am still going. She is just a genius. Just brilliant. And then in my normal life, I don't think I have a normal life. I am also a writer. So right now I have an agent. I'm on submission. And hopefully someday I will have a book out. But I write fantasy, but there's always sex in it because I'm a dirty, dirty girl.
So do you write romantasy or do you write fantasy, but it also has sex in it?
It's fantasy, but it also has sex. So I call it romantic fantasy because, like, there's always going to be an HEA, but it's probably going to be after four books and, like, a lot of death and murder. and, like, maybe my heroine won't end up with the guy she first slept with. Maybe she'll end up with the guys.
Scandalo.
I know.
One of my favorite moments in this book, actually, is there's a moment where Aiden/Declan is trying to shame Regan for, like, agreeing to sleep with him so readily. And she is like basically, like, whoring myself for you. Maybe I'm whoring myself for the sake of whoring.
Yes.
Like, sex is great, and I miss it with you. And I may have, like, fist bumped. Like, yes, it was a really great moment in the book. So
there's another one where they've just had, like, a fist fight, and he's, like, you know, pinning her down and, like, thrusting and all that stuff. And he's like, oh, you would just let me fuck you on the ground like a common whore? And she's like, well, if you keep thrusting like that, I'm going to have to demand it. I'm like, yes, girl, you're so good.
Yes. So tell us about Declan, though, because it's not typically a hero that people are drawn to. Although, I think Sarah and I both have agreed we're Team Declan now. But tell us more about why he's always appealed
to you. Well, but wait a second. So, Sarah, have you always been Team Declan, like, from the very start?
Yeah.
And you read them in order. So, like, you got to Declan in order.
It wasn't like the second he walked on page, I wasn't like, oh, yeah, the great torture man.
But you were like ooh, vivisector.
I wasn't even looking forward to this book because, are we saying Regan or Regan? I never know how to say that.
Regan. We're on Team Regan.
Okay. So I was never really that into Regan. And I was like, oh, it's going to be Regan and, like, the torture guy. And then I picked up the book and I was just obsessed. And it's my favorite. It completely turned around Regan for me, too. Like, this book is as good as it is because she is so funny. You need that in a book this dark. But Declan Chase is just such a very, very sad man. And I find his... I call him Torture Bay.
Baby.
Declan Chase, Torture Bay.
You know what Sarah said last time about Malcolm? She's like, you like him broke. You just like him broke different. And I feel like that's our new tagline.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's just like his backstory is just unspeakably tragic. So he has had this punishing anxiety his entire life. And it's, you know, supernatural in origin because he is a reincarnation looking for his mate. But he has just felt awful his entire life. He turned to heroin to try and like feel better as a teenager. He, you know, was estranged from his family, and he goes back to try and like steal money so he can get a fix, and he finds his brother dead and his parents being just devoured alive by these awful monsters who then like peel the skin off him for days. So you've got the 17-year-old heroin addict whose entire family is gone, and then he gets picked up by the military, and his father figure, the guy who steps in to be his father figure, is like, look, they're all like this. All immortals are like this. They're all monsters. Even if they look beautiful, even if they seem reasonable, they want to do to you what those things did to you. And so he ends up brainwashed, tortured again in like the military care, because they want to like make him, they said, to take down these monsters, you have to become one. And so he's just been completely demolished by the only people that ever took him in and saw any worth in him. And so now he runs, you know, a torture facility, which is not great, where they're, you know, vivisecting
people. It's not the best job.
It's not the best job. But, like, he's horribly scarred, and, like, he doesn't want anyone to see his skin, and he's just miserable all the time, and he's, like, still shooting up. He's just shooting up officially doctor-sanctioned drugs. Yeah, because they're like, oh, this is to, and it's to hide his berserker tendencies. He doesn't realize he's one of these creatures, and he's so resistant to it. And I find his arc just so heartbreaking because, like, I think everyone at some point in their life has felt like a monster, and he really is one. And like, I've felt like that too. And I don't torture people. You know, I haven't gone perhaps as far into monstrousness, but the idea that you can just loathe yourself so deeply and that you can think there's no way I can ever come back from what I am and who I am, and there's no way anyone will ever care about this thing I am. And the idea that you're never too far gone. You know, he ran a torture facility, and he's responsible for pulling himself back out of that hole, you know, with Regan's help, and like rediscovering how to live and how to love another person and how to accept being loved. But like, that is just so hard. And I think it's like everyone in IAD is a little monstrous, but it's more like fun for a lot of them. They're like, oh, like Lothair is like, oh, yeah, I will garrote you with your own viscera. And like, they're kind of used to this. And this is just this wretched, absolutely destroyed man who's convinced there's nothing of worth and has nothing to live for except for, you know, vivisecting people. And just seeing like that, it hit me, I think, deeper. And I think part of it is because he's human. And the suffering just feels a lot more like it sticks more because he didn't go into this knowing he was an immortal. Like, he's young. Right. He's a young immortal as it goes. He's like under 40. And he's already gone through all of this. So I just think that's something really beautiful.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because we talked about how Caro is essentially like 40. And one of the things that's really interesting is she's still this like wild one, but he's more like toxic masculinity personified. Yep. And I think the part that you were like the we're all monsters part, but the thing that's really appealing about reading about something monstrous that can be like redeemed is that like no one's lost forever, right?
Yeah. And this actually, I was thinking about that. That's basically a line from the new Star Wars. And, you know, I've been like diving into some Star Wars fan fiction. It's very much a Kylo Ren character type. This is a character I love. I also like the heroine of the book that I'm on submission with is monstrous. She's a survivor of child abuse who has turned herself into something really hard and terrible just to live. And her arc is also about coming to terms with, like, how do you reconcile your humanity with the things you've done and the things
you've become. Sure, it's like the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so, like, I'm deeply invested in hoping Kylo Ren gets a redemption arc, because especially if you look into some of the stuff outside the movies, you're like, wow, this is a really miserable, tragic backstory. And the idea that you can have these toxic people who are doing awful things and are examples of toxic masculinity, and they can still be redeemed. Like, I know we're not at a point in time where listening to the oppressor's narrative is super interesting, but it is important, I think, to know that you can come back from that. You can be redeemed, and you don't have to be like a horrible misogynist forever, or you don't have to be a racist forever, or no matter what you've done, there is some chance for you to come back from that edge. I don't know. It's just it's a character trait I've always liked, but I've always been like a villain fucker, so maybe that's part of it too.
Fine. You got to own that, Sarah, and that's okay too. I think it's really interesting, I think, to think about like when, I mean, like I wouldn't read a book about like a Nazi hero or mm-mm. a Confederate hero. So one of the ways this works is to explore that kind of evilness outside of like actual reality. Historical truth and reality makes it a much easier way to like engage in that for sure.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want the Nazi narrative either, even though that's kind of what this is. He's running an internment camp. Like, we're about as close to that as we can get, but paranormal lets us back away.
Yeah, it is genocidal, what's happening here. Like, mm-hmm. he's, you know, I mean, he's performing medical experiments on an entire class of people. But because, you know, Jen, you've said this 1,000 times over the course of this podcast, but like because immortality is on the table, the stakes can be mm-hmm. way beyond anything that we would ever allow in a human hero in a human world doing human atrocity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's also something that makes it work here because the people being oppressed are, you know, the gorgeous, immortal, perfect scions of this world. Like, they have power. And so it doesn't feel as bad to see, like, Lothair being burned to a crisp by Declan. Because you're sure. like, Lothair has been, like, murdering people for millennia, you know? And right. it doesn't feel as much, it's more like the privileged people are the ones actually being incarcerated. So it's a lot easier to read. And I don't think I would enjoy Declan as much if he wasn't.
Those were humans.
If those were humans, I don't think I could forgive that. But no, she always raises the stakes so high with the
through the roof,
the paranormal stuff. And I think that's the only way you could engage with something like this and not have it be completely repellent.
I think you're really onto something because I think it's also about knowing that everyone who is harmed will be able to be magically regenerated from physical violence. Whereas if it was sexual violence, I would also be straight fucking out.
Yeah, that would also be a no. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways this could go where this would be an absolute deal breaker for me, but she is just such a master at her craft and making people who have done awful things sympathetic that, like, you know, vivisection isn't great, but...
Yeah, she never oversteps the line either. That's what's amazing. Yeah. She seems to always show us exactly where the line is, and then she'll mm-hmm. toe it. But ultimately, she knows how far she can push us, which is amazing, particularly when you're talking about a character who has vivisected beloved character. I mean, beloved characters in the series.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, and there's also a really interesting thing about, I think, addiction mm-hmm. And self-medicating that he's like a really interesting character to like sort of dive into some of that. But I also think the idea of, like, he is not aware that Regan is being vivisected. And I, even though she is, he's unaware of it and didn't know about it. And I have to say, I think that would have also, like, if he'd known.
Yep. Sure.
Right? So it's like, there's that line again, right? It happened to her, but he didn't know and he wasn't aware.
And going up to the line, like, he did torture her. He gave her 3 drops of pain poison and then, like, noped out and realized he couldn't do it. And I didn't, that wasn't too far for me. No. I think if it had gotten worse than that, I think it would have been. But she gets right up to that line. This is interesting because I know we've been talking about morality chain periodically. This one mm-hmm. isn't like a morality chain romance because he realizes what he's done and knows he's a monster. And it's not just because of Regan. He's not doing it. She's sort of his anchor back to sanity. In a way.
Wait, say more about that, because I was thinking about this and I actually had I had the same thought but I came down on it is a morality chain romance because he, for a length of time during the book, seems unable to hurt her, but perfectly willing to hurt other people.
Oh.
Yeah, but I think at the end, though, the thing that makes me come down on this is not morality chain is that by the end of the book, I don't think he's doing it just for her. Like,
Mm. Yeah.
It's like Lothair is the kind of guy who'll be like, okay, well, I know you don't like me killing people, so I'm not going to kill people. Declan's the guy who's like, well, I feel a little better about myself, so I'm probably not going to vivisect anyone.
But I think that's a literal line from Lothair. Like, oh, no,
it
fine.
Is, it totally is. He's like, oh, you know.
Right. I'd say it's both and in that, like, morality chain, if you think about it, like, this is my chain back to humanity. I think he just moves further towards humanity. Like, she gets him there, right? Like, yeah. She, like, it's, like, literally, like, let me throw you a line and, like, reel you back in, mm-hmm. which is also really interesting to talk about, like, making someone more human when this is about the world of immortals.
Yeah.
For listeners who maybe don't know what we're talking about when we say morality chain, Well, Sarah, why don't you explain what morality chain romance is? And then also, people have asked us to do an interstitial on morality chain, and okay. I think we do have one on the list coming. So,
yeah, well, so morality chain is basically when a hero or heroine only does the right thing because of their love interest. So you get like a sociopath who's like, well, you know, I have no problem, you know, destroying people's lives, but, you know, my soft-hearted girlfriend really doesn't like that. So, like, I do it for her. And it's basically just having the being able to, like, have awful people be, like, the sexy bad boys they are, while also maybe cutting down on the behaviors that we don't actually want to fantasize about in the future.
To me, I feel like every time I experience it, it's like I think of it being, like, it's like a space station. Right? And the bad guy's out there in space, and there's, like, that one tether that connects them back to the space station. And that's, yeah. like, the chain, right? Like, if it wasn't for that one person linking them, they would just, like, drift off and do all their crazy bad shit. Yeah. But I often find that morality chain trope, like, that trope, which I love, is... It's like there was no chain, right? And then this love interest comes along and all of a sudden it is. It's like they're this chasm away and someone's like throwing them a line and saying like, come back, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like
it's a very common trope right now in dark romance because it is the sort of – in dark romance, especially contemporary dark romance, that's where we really see like heroes doing – I mean, are they even really – heroes – who are called heroes because literature requires that they're called heroes for this conversation, doing terrible, terrible things, sometimes to the heroine, and then being brought low and returned to humanity by her. Mm-hmm. It's tricky to do it really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And well, we'll talk about it more next week for the next book with Lothair. But I definitely went back and forth on Declan and it potentially being here too. But it's interesting to hear you think not, Sarah.
Well, I think it becomes self-generated enough. Like she is the lifeline, but in the end, like she's not the only thing tethering him. You know, he's got Brander. He's got a lot of guilt.
That's a good point.
I think a lot of time the morality chain. Heroes, to me, don't seem very guilty about what they've done.
Yeah, guilt. Guilt is interesting.
Yeah. The one thing I did wish he had done is that I think Regan sets up the Declan Chase Restitution Fund in his name, and I wish that he had done that himself instead of, like, her being like, and then let's do this.
Now you're going to get sad and his mom and grandma a mansion.
But, like, what a wifey thing to do, right? Where you're like, oh, I'll just fix this for you.
Yeah.
Like, this goes back to this question of, like, women doing the emotional work always in all situations.
I will say, I don't know if anybody else thought this, but when Thad started calling him DC instead of Declan Chase... I thought it was this
Thad
not. I know that.
So bro-y. Thad. So bro-y.
It is. But you know what else it was? I thought it was like this really subtle way of Thad saying, like, you've got all of the characteristics of being a superhero. Mm. But now you just have to act differently.
Look at you, Jen. DC.
I love their little bro road trip. What a wonderful. And they're just like, and Thad's just like, does anyone want a beer? While like Lothair is being like, okay, this is how you capture her heart is by being more evil. Like, and he's totally right. And like, I love everything about that. I'm just like,
yeah.
Was it some line about like taking love advice from like a multi-millennia old source of undiluted evil?
Yes.
And like, and it works. No, there's so much charming about this book. Yeah, and I think because there is so much on the back half where they break out of the order, and then, you know, Declan has to go through withdrawals again, and then he has to, like, cry a whole bunch as, like, Regan gets wires ripped out of her rib cage, and, like, he really has to go through the emotional pain. And I think if Torture Island had lasted a little longer in the compound, there wouldn't have been as much time to be like, oh, look, Declan Chase is, like, kind of trying.
He's sad. Declan Chase. I was like, I want that on a t-shirt.
Chase is kind of trying.
Yeah. That's amazing. Okay. Yeah. One of the things I was really interested in, though, is we do get, like, these four other incarnations. Like, right? We get Aiden and the other dudes, right? Edward and Gabriel or whoever. And I, one of the things I thought was really interesting is in each of those incarnations, like, Aiden takes over.
Yeah.
So why did you think that Aiden couldn't take over Declan? Like, why do you think Declan was able to, like, stay on top of that?
Because he's had to recover from just the worst trauma imaginable. Like, he broke so badly that it's, you can't really break him again, you know? He came back and he's just, like, he's too strong from having experienced everything he's experienced. And, like, I personally am so bored by all the incarnations and I, like, super hate Aiden. I find him more reprehensible than Declan Chase because he was just, he was domineering. He was like kind of creepy when she was 12. Like, he's like, you know, my woman will stay here. Like, he wasn't great about consent. Like, Aiden just sucks. And they did like the perfect Viking. And I'm like, this guy sucks so hard. And then the other incarnations are boring. And then Declan Chase, where she's like, this is the wretched version. This is the tortured version. This is all the pain and hate that this perfect guy had. And instead, he sort of spawned into this new, more interesting thing where he isn't perfect. And I think because he's experienced victimhood, which Aiden hadn't, he's more able to empathize with her. Like, he wants her to be his hunting partner. And he, like,
yeah.
When it's so sad when he's like, you're my friend. And she's like, oh my God.
Oh, I know.
Like, I am Declan, like, Chase's only friend. Yeah. And, like, it's just so sad where he sees her as sort of this equal in a way that Aiden never did. And he's just this. I do think the victimhood changed him. Like, Aiden never had to suffer, but Declan had to fight back from that. So,
yeah, I think you're really right about that. I want to read a little bit from the bit where Lothair is teaching, is listening to them, like, coach him on how to get Regan. This is before Lothair is like, let me tell you how to get a Valkyrie. Oh. But he's like, I knew of Aiden the Fierce. No mortal could kill that many of the Horde without my hearing about it. And I know that he was a bold, blonde Viking who was like a god among men. Women wanted him and men wanted to be him. He sighed. Reminded me of myself. Then he jerked his chin.
This book is so amazing.
He's amazing. He jerked his chin at Declan and says, Chase here is a coal-haired, scarred, underhanded, emotionally deficient Irishman who incidentally is loathed universally by immortals and mortals alike. First of all, like, Lothair, the truth teller, is pretty magnificent here, but also, like, that's the moment where you sort of realize, like, he has to change. He has to sort of become something completely different in order to win Regan. And she, and I really think that in this case, she doesn't spend any time with the other guys trying to get them to change or evolve or be nuanced or anything. Like, she just falls into bed with them.
And I think Aiden actually, to me, is the epitome of male privilege. You know, we're talking about Declan being toxic masculinity. Like, Aiden's like, well, of course I get a Valkyrie. I deserve her. She's mine by right. All of these things are mine.
Her father, he's so arrogant about Woden.
Yes.
Yeah. And he's just like, and so he's used to being getting whatever he wants. And he's like big and muscled and blonde and perfect. And like, of course I deserve a daughter of the gods. And like, you'll do what I say. And just like, wait here. I'll come back from battle and like, fuck you sometimes. Like, he's not great.
This is making me realize, though, that at the end, like at the very end, part of the one of the scenes that I love the most in the book is when Regan goes for the rock and like attacks the rock and screams at Woden is like, you owe this to me because it's been, she sort of turns itself on its head and she's like, I deserve this from you.
Yeah.
Because I've suffered. Look at how I have fought and I have suffered.
Yeah.
One of the things I want to just like swing back to, and I meant to talk about, I really also think that every incarnation of Aiden is the incarnation of a certain kind of romance hero. And I remember very fucking vividly reading a love-swept romance by Irish Johansson. Remember her? Called White Satin. I just looked up. I think I bought a copy on Thrift Books because I love that shit. And she was like a 12 or 14-year-old like figure skater. And in this story, she's practicing with this guy who's like 20. And he recognizes that there's this attraction between them, but it's creepy because she's so young. But it's all very controlling. He's very Aiden-like, right? Mm-hmm. And then I think then you get like Gabriel, like the pirate.
Yeah, the lusty pirate. Yeah.
Yes. And then you get just like the cinnamon roll Edward. And I think that like what we're also seeing is like, not just that like heroes change, but that heroines change, and what we need from like the men in our lives has changed. And I think that that's one thing this book is really doing is like showing us like, hey, remember this guy and then this guy and then this guy. And they all can be part of who romance is right now, but it's not who we need anymore.
Now we need the torturers.
Fine.
More torture. No, it's funny though, because Regan just kind of, for being such a tough character, does kind of just get swept along by the other incarnations. This is the first one where it feels like it's really been a fair fight in a way. And that's also what I really love about their dynamic, is that it's a power struggle. And it's not just her being walked all over by like the handsome Viking.
Well, it's almost like Aiden was sort of prescient at the beginning of this when he was like, when you're grown up, we're going to be mated. Yep. Because it's almost like it's taken this long for Regan to become grown up enough to acknowledge the need for love and how complicated it is.
Yeah. Like the long half-life of an immortal adolescent is basically what her story is, right?
Think of all the voicemail messages she left for Lucia during that book, where she was like, I'm playing video games and you suck and I hate you, but I love you. But when are you coming back? And like, oh my God, I miss you. Like, she's like a toddler.
Yeah. And she's been emotionally dependent on Lucia for so long. And then this is the first book where she's on her own and she kind of doesn't have that anymore. So it's like she also gets everything stripped away from her.
Absolutely.
Her friends and her comfort and her intoxibongs or whatever, her intoxispells. And like she's also just having to start over again. And she's broken like all the way down. Just figure out how to get her feel back.
Can we also talk about sex in this book?
Yes.
Because there isn't a whole lot of it.
But what there is fucking hot.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, there can't be a whole lot of it, right?
I mean, this has one of my favorite sexy scenes in any romance ever, and it doesn't even end in sex or, like, anything. It's the bathtub scene.
Presley Cole must have an amazing bathtub in her house because she is inspired.
No, but like, so between the fist fight where they end up like grinding on the ground, I was like, we're off to the races.
We talked about that in the other part of this episode, where
he's like, okay, I don't want to hear about all these like sexy, like incarnations of me you have had sex with. Like, I don't really want to hear about them. What would you tell someone about me? He's also assuming that he's not going to last.
So
he's like, what will you tell the next one? Like, obviously once I'm dead. And she just starts talking about like, it turns into dirty talk, and she's in the tub just like moaning and being like, you would, blah, 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 you would do this. And he just like flips out, loses it, drags her out of the bathtub, puts her on the counter, and then desperately wants to touch her, but like doesn't want her to see the cigars on his hands. So he blindfolds her, and then he just starts like gently touching her. He like pokes the tip of her ear, and he like, and it's just the smallest things. And I was like, this is the hottest thing I have ever read. It's just like, her naked, blindfolded, while Declan Chase, like, gradually, like, gets more comfortable touching her.
It's true.
So, well, it's also torturous, right? He's torturing her.
Yeah.
Not intentionally, but, like, it's the torture of, like, she knows it can't consummate. Like, there's no way it's happening there then.
Yeah.
Well, and the fact that then Webb walks in is so, like, it bursts that bubble. Like, literally, it's so... It feels more invasive than almost any other thing he does in the book. And he does a lot of shit.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, it made me so sad. I was like, oh, God. And that's like the beginning of the long slog through everyone being sad all the time until you can get back to the sexy stuff.
Until Thad opens the beer.
Yeah. that's true. Like,
I think it's time for beer.
Another bathing scene, like, that one's hot too, where it just ends up like a fist fight turns into 69ing, and I'm like, I love this. I love this dynamic. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I've always been a sucker for like fight fucking.
It's awesome. Everyone loves that. Everyone loves that. Yeah. You know what also is a really funny part of that is when Lothair, when she finds out that Declan, it's a really fascinating scene where she catches Lothair feeding from Declan.
Yeah.
And she notices that Lothair has an erection and she's super grossed out by it. But also like, what if it had been Brander? That might have been hot, which is like this really funny moment. And then, you know, what she says to him, though, pretty quickly is he's going to be able to see what we did together. Mm. And then Lothair's like, you assholes, I've been watching you all along.
Oh, Lothair is the best.
But I thought that was really interesting that that's what it was like. You're going to know about me and my sisters or whatever. But very quickly, it's like he's going to be able to see how we were together.
Yeah. Which is sad.
Yeah. It was interesting because this is a craft thing, but I actually really thought at some point that Lothair was going to dream the past. Like, because I feel like Lothair is so critical to the plot of this book that I really did have a moment where I was like, oh, Lothair's going to dream, you know, Aiden or Gabriel or something. And, like, be part of explaining. Because it is, that, to your point, Jen, over the last couple of weeks, like, it is a cheat, right? And it would be sort of an extra cheat if someone else dreamed the memory and then, like, reported it back to you.
You know what? I will say the one, like, sex thing that I really found a bit confounding in this book is at the beginning when Aiden first sleeps with her.
Yeah.
And it'd been 7 months and he'd been holding off. It was not clear to me at all, like, what made it so urgent. I mean, I guess it was just like berserker rage or whatever, but what set him onto that path? Yeah, but he'd been battling like all the fucking time, like battle. Like, I just didn't get, I guess he had been kept from her, right?
Yeah,
He's like, they're going to try and keep you from me or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't just a battle. It was like the vampires had got him behind enemy lines and he didn't know if he was going to return to her. And he was like, why haven't I been having sex with her this whole time? Which is a valid question. I also wondered why they weren't having sex the whole time. But
yeah.
I didn't like that sex scene because she kept saying no he just kind of kept going. And, like, just because she eventually is like, all right, this is happening, let's do it, isn't enough for me. So I hate Aiden so much.
Well, I do think that it's one of the reasons, though, that then in a very similar kind of scene at the end, it's clearer, her consent is clearer.
Yeah.
The idea that they're both in charge of it. So I guess I do feel like we needed to see that scene to see, like, that morph and change kind of in the, like, right? We need to see that, like, on both sides.
I wish there was more sex in it, though.
Sure. I would say, sure, of course. Read the Game Maker series. Sarah, here's my question before we wrap up. Anything that you were like, I really wanted to bring up or talk about before we, this was amazing, but I'm like, anything you were like, oh, I definitely wanted to talk about XYZ?
Me? No. I'm just glad we got to talk about War Monsters Deserving Love. No. And then maybe we could have spent more time on Regan. Like, Regan's just so great. Regan's the kind of heroine I love reading about in romances because it is absolutely the opposite of me, where I am like a strange, anxious creature who will, like, use my words rather than my fists. And I've always wished I could be just a blunt ass kicker, and I'm not. And so I love reading about them. Mel Jean Brook has another good one in Demon Forged that I'm like, that's never going to be me, but, like, damn, that would be awesome if it was. But just how funny she was, and, like, this book has some of the funniest lines in the whole series, and it's just
the
darkest one.
Yes.
And you're like, that's such a strange combination where I'm like, this is hysterical, and also our heroine's ribcage just got cracked open. So, like, that's a lot. That's a lot.
It is. I think the saddest thing for me, there's a part where after the vivisection where she's dim, her light's gone.
Yeah.
And she's kind of like, it might not come back. But then it does through orgasm, so fine.
There you go. I was going to say healed through orgasm, and they had to just fuck it out, as Kate says.
Yeah. Oh, and can we talk about Natalia and how great she is and how I want her to
She's
be the
great.
Heroine of a book?
She's so good.
She's so good.
Do you think she's going to end up being for Thad?
Maybe. Oh, that's so funny. She's just thirsting after Thad.
He's so
young.
He's so young.
It's
But he's 1,000 years old, remember, Sarah?
Yeah. Yeah, he's very
spoiler alert. I know. Well, we're spoiling that. Spoiler, 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 spoiler.
That's actually kind of Lothair's morality chain, too.
That's
everyone's morality. He's like, hey, DC, hey, Lothair. And it's like, he's the only other one that's like, oh, yeah, let me tether these horrific people to some idea of decency. Like, let's all drink some brewskis together. I love Thad. What a weird kid.
I love Thad.
He's actually best, I think, in this book. Like, I think in the next book, because he's in Lothair.
Yeah.
He's a big piece of Lothair. But when he comes back in Sweet Ruin, he's not the same character in that book. So it's interesting to see what she's doing with him, because she's clearly evolving him in some way.
Why don't we wrap up? And Sarah, thank you for joining us. This was amazing.
Thank you for letting me talk about my love of Declan Chase. I was really nervous ahead of time because I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go on a podcast and explain why The Torture Man is my favorite. It feels complicated. I'm trying to figure out how to articulate it. It's just, yeah, we do like I'm broke a little different. But no.
We are Team Declan, weirdly now. Thank you so much, Sarah, for joining us. This was amazing. We are so excited. You guys, Lothair is next. Here we come. It's so exciting. You are listening to Fated Mates. If you haven't headed over to your favorite podcasting app and subscribed, we would love for you to do that. You won't want to miss Lothair, which will probably be a double episode, let's be honest.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's got to be.
And make sure that you give us a rating, hopefully a good one, and leave us a review, hopefully a good one. Tell your friends. Tell your mom. Tell, you know, your favorite Valkyrie. And find us on Twitter at Fated Mates. Find us on Instagram at Fated Mates Pod. What else? Next week we have a new interstitial. And
that's it.
We'll see you next time.
Va foutre un porcel. Dame, défendis-tu le terrain? À la mort, ripaud.